The story in John 9 is in part a miracle story. Jesus gives sight to a man born blind. That's a big miracle. Today, I have my sights set on a smaller miracle. That is, to have you give your attention to a biblical story that's 41 verses long. Come to think, I'm not sure which would be more amazing. But take heart, I will help you. And I have hope that this story will help us too. That's because the ancient stories of the Bible are all about giving us eyes to glimpse good news in hard times, to move us beyond fear and despair into the light of God's life-giving grace. So when you read this story, si se puede, you might hear something new, something surprising. Like, first of all, it's not so much a miracle story. The healing part only takes 2 verses. The other 39 verses cover the ensuing controversy, which involves a huge cast of characters. In addition to Jesus and the man born blind, there are the disciples, the neighbors, the Pharisees, the temple authorities, and the parents. They all get their moment on center stage in this 7-act tragic comedy. And what's the controversy about? Well, that part's clear. It's mentioned from beginning to end in John 9. It's blindness. Sure, there's the physical blindness of one man, but the blindness this story is really concerned about is metaphorical blindness. So don't be a literalist. John 9 is focused on those who think they see, but can't grasp what is right in front of their face. The story begins with the line, "As Jesus walked along, he saw a man blind from birth." But Wes Howard Brook points out that we could just as easily translate the Greek as making a poignant description of human reality. As Jesus walked along, he saw humanity blind from birth. We all share in the condition of the story's main character. The accompanying disciples respond to this sighting with a theological question. How did this come to be, they ask. Did he sin or did his parents? That was a real question in biblical times. The book of Exodus has one answer. Ezekiel 18 has another. And today, people have their own form of this question. Some ask, is this blindness a failure of personal responsibility, or is it due to structural evil? Others ask, is this about nature or nurture? Still others, is this about chicken or egg? The debates ensue. But Jesus is not so interested. He goes about the work of relieving suffering. And he goes about it in a very unorthodox and earthy way. Jesus spits in the dirt, rubs the saliva together in his hands, and smears, or perhaps anoints, it on the man's eyes. That's right, he rubs his dirty spit on the blind man's face. What would the Centers for Disease Control say about that? But remember, John's aim here isn't to be literal. Think Genesis and the creation story, where humanity is created out of clay. So here Jesus is recreating humanity, giving sight to a people who have lost it. And after the man's eyes are packed with mud, Jesus instructs him to wash in the pool of Siloam, otherwise known as the pool of sending. The allusion here is baptism. So the image in this part of the story is of a new creation called and sent to do God's work. See this, and you'll start to grasp what this tale is all about. Now, one might think that a story in which sight is restored would end with a party. Another occasion to use that water-to-wine-making gift. But that's not what happens here. Instead, we get a parade of party poopers. First, we hear from the man's neighbors, who seem stupefied that such a thing could happen. And then we hear from the Pharisees, who insist Jesus did it all wrong by healing on the Sabbath and deviating from God's right and proper order. And next comes the powerful temple authorities, who dismiss the healing story as fake news, knowing full well that if word gets out, it will undermine their authority. They initiate a campaign to discredit the story by interrogating the man's parents. They do so because they know the leverage they have over them. If the parents dare stand up to this witch hunt and confess Jesus as the one who brings sight, they will suffer ridicule, disfavor with the communal authorities, and will be cast out of the only place they belonged. This is not unlike what still happens to those who bring God's word of justice and love in the world today. Tragically, in this story, the parents deflect and pass the buck back to their son. They could not muster the courage to leap the chasm from the world's ways to the way of God that transcends earthly authorities and even the law itself. The story continues with ever more amusing dialogue, and John keeps inviting us to see ourselves in these characters who suffer from some level of blindness. Yet we may be tempted to claim the loftier status of the formerly blind. After all, we are progressive. We are educated. We can see how blind and ridiculous those who disagree with us are. Surely we are not blind, are we? Ezra Klein, in his new book, Why We're Polarized, describes how it is precisely the more educated who are most likely to spin uncomfortable truths in a way that allows us to cleverly conclude our side is always right. His empirical support for this includes studies that found smart people talking themselves into wrong answers on brain teasers, where the right answers had ideological implications they disliked. And we don't even see what we're doing. To worship God is to confess our blindness, our failures to see, our fealty with the ways of the world, and our fear. We gain our sight by welcoming God's new order and working the works, as it's put in verse 4, of that new order. In other words, by getting our hands dirty, metaphorically, in the building of the kinship of God. In a time of global pandemic, when a virus has so powerfully demonstrated our deep interconnectedness with one another, and when we can so plainly see the truth of 1 Corinthians that when one of us is suffering, we are all impacted in profound ways. May we be recreated with new sight to reclaim the baptismal vow of following the way of Jesus.